I'm sure you've heard my cats in the background, or I've talked about my fur babies. I love them, but I don't love the smell of the cat litter. And no matter what I did, it would still smell. But now I've found Live Odor Free. Live Odor Free has several indoor and outdoor three-step kits to suit your needs, and it naturally eliminates odors on contact. I don't like using products with a lot of chemicals, especially not around my cats. Live Odor Free products don't use enzymes, fragrance, or detergents, making it safe for pets and kids. Their liquid odor technology is organic, natural, non-GMO, and green. Get 20% off of your purchase. Link is in the description. Welcome to season 3 of the podcast. Thank you so much for joining today. On Thursday, May the 6th, 1976, a maroon 1972 Thunderbird was parked in a West Side neighborhood of Chicago, Illinois. It was kind of a shady area, so there was something suspicious about a car like that being there. And a few calls were made to the police station. The officer responding arrived at about 2 p.m. and noticed that the car had an Elk Grove Village sticker in the front window. There were no hubcaps. The front window had been smashed and was covered by a piece of cardboard, and the ignition had been pulled. Because other more valuable car parts weren't taken, the officer believed that the Thunderbird had been stolen by amateurs. A license plate check revealed that the car was registered to a man named Frank, but it had not been reported stolen. The address was a suburb of Elk Grove Village, about 20 minutes northwest of Chicago. Elk Grove Village at one time was home to farmers and German immigrants, and it eventually developed into a residential community. The easy commute to the airport helped the population double in the 1960s, and it continued expanding with new housing, roads, schools, and businesses. The growth would continue into the 1970s and through the 1980s, and Elk Grove Village would have the largest consolidated business park in North America. In 1976, Elk Grove Village was considered safe from the crime that was in bigger cities like Chicago. Frank was a successful auto parts salesman, and he had no reason to be in that neighborhood. So the officer attempted to phone his residence. He tried multiple times over the next hour or so, only getting the beeping of a busy signal. He then sent the information to the Elk Grove Village Police Department. On Friday, May 7th, around 4:45 p.m., an officer was dispatched to Frank's home to inform the occupants that the car had been found in Chicago. Upon arriving, the officer immediately noticed several days' worth of newspaper and mail was gathered around the front porch. The screen door was closed, but unlocked, and the front door to the house was slightly open. The officer received no response when he knocked on the door and announced himself. He did hear a dog barking from inside. He called for backup, and while waiting, he walked the perimeter of the exterior of the house. Noting that there were no other cars in the driveway or garage, An earlier background check showed that Frank was married and had two teenage children. All of the windows and doors appeared intact and secure, except for that front door. When the backup officer arrived, both men entered the residence. They found Frank dead in the living room. He was 43 years old. He was lying on his back, dressed in a t-shirt, plaid pants, and socks. He was surrounded by broken glass, and a torn and bloody lampshade was nearby. To the officers, he had clearly been dead for several days. The officers continued to walk the residence, and they found Frank's wife, Mary. She was also dead. She was lying on her back outside of the bathroom. She had a bullet wound on the bridge of her nose, literally right between the eyes. She also had a 1-inch slash across her throat. She was 40 years old. The bathroom had gold filigree tiles that Mary had hand-painted. Filigree work is created by carefully twisting, untwisting, curling, and or plaiting together thin threads of pliable precious metals. So it was a lot of work that she put into decorating the bathroom. It's kind of sad that she was found by this room that she worked so hard to make beautiful. Part of an artificial plant and a bloody magazine were lying next to her body. Broken glass and beads were scattered by her head. The officers immediately called for an investigative unit. At 5 p.m., Investigator Rose of the Elk Grove Police Department arrived on scene. He viewed the bodies of Frank and Mary and noticed that Mary was still wearing a large diamond ring on her left hand. Her purse was found in the bathroom, its contents on the floor, as well as a cigarette case and an ashtray. Investigator Rose found 4 human teeth lying between the top of the stairs and the wall. He continued to investigate the rest of the house and found 13-year-old Michael dead in his bedroom. He was lying on his back wearing a white t-shirt and blue sweatpants. His head was bloody and he appeared to have bullet wounds to the left side of his body, as well as one on his back. He also had multiple stab wounds to his neck and chest. A pair of gold-plated scissors were found next to a desk and a bowling trophy with a marble base was lying next to his body. Both items were bloody. Walking through the rest of the house, Investigator Rose found a crumpled up magazine, loose coins, beads, and portions of artificial ferns on the floor of the foyer. In the kitchen, the garbage had been dumped on the floor and most of its contents were bloody. One of the cabinets was open. The telephone was off the hook and a personal telephone directory book was open to a page that had the name and number of Frank and Mary's oldest child, Patricia, or Patty as she was known. In their master bedroom upstairs, the covers were pulled down as if someone was getting ready for bed, but the sheets were smooth, indicating no one had slept there. Everything appeared orderly, like there was no ransacking. The alarm clock, which had been set to 9 a.m., was still buzzing. outside of the house a 9-inch knife and a steak knife were found in the rock garden. Valuable items were left in the home, a TV, a CB radio, an 8-track recorder, stereo equipment, cameras, projectors, a .40 caliber shotgun, and the diamond ring that Mary wore. These items were visible but left untouched. There was also a wall safe that contained $5,000 in cash. There was no attempt to open the safe or pry it open. In his opinion, Investigator Rose said that the valuable items being left behind, the fact that all of the windows were intact, the back door was locked, the front door showed no pry marks or forced entry, and the phone lines were not cut, so that discounted robbery as a motive. Detectives tried to contact Patty to let her know what had happened, but they couldn't find her. I believe I read that they attempted to call her friends, and then they told her friends what happened and asked them to tell Patty and let her know to come to the police station if she had any information to provide. Detectives and law enforcement know that people respond to situations differently. Some people show no emotion, especially around investigators, or because they're still in shock. And some have no control over their emotions. Some cry uncontrollably. Everyone acts differently, and sometimes in unusual ways or ways that might not seem appropriate at the time. So when Patty came into the police station, their spidey senses started to tingle, and they just thought something was off. Patty was not distraught or in tears. She was not in shock. She matter-of-factly told the detectives that her father, Frank, had ties with the mob. According to Patty, Frank ran a mob chop shop for stolen cars behind the auto parts shop, and that probably led to the murders. Detectives made note of her story, as well as that she openly flirted with male officers, and she was dressed rather seductively. On Saturday, May the 8th, the chief medical examiner of Cook County performed the autopsies. The body of Frank had irregular lacerations from a blunt object, probably a heavy lamp or the bowling trophy that was found near Michael's body. Frank had suffered 4 gunshot wounds, one to the right side of his face, one to the left side of his face, one to his lower lip, and then the other to the left side of his head, behind his ear. He also sustained cuts from a sharp instrument and had 4 missing teeth. Mary died from the gunshot wound she sustained between her eyes. It was likely that she was already dead by the time her body fell to the floor, and her heart stopped beating when her throat was slashed. Michael died after being shot at close range in the head. After being shot, he was bludgeoned with a heavy instrument before his chest and neck were stabbed or punctured more than 90 times. The medical examiner felt that the stab or puncture wounds were shallow enough that they could possibly have been administered by a female. A single foreign hair was recovered from the front of Michael's t-shirt at the time of the autopsy. DNA wasn't available at the time, but the hair would later be determined to be microscopically indistinguishable from the hair of his sister Patty. Based on stomach contents of the family and the lack of rigor mortis, that's when the body is stiff, the medical examiner estimated that they died between 11 p.m. on May the 4th and 1 a.m. on May the 5th, 1976. At the time of the autopsies, an evidence technician for the Elk Grove Police Department pried open the trunk of Frank's Thunderbird. The technician noted that there were dark maroon or red smudges on the trunk, visible from 5 feet away, and that the smudges could have been from either grease or blood. Unfortunately, the smudges were contaminated, and so they were unable to be compared. The handprints were found on the fender and the trunk of the car. These prints came from the left hand of a person who was either missing a left pointer finger, the tip of it, or the finger did not make an impression, which is unlikely. Glass was recovered from the floor of the car's interior, as well as takeout bags from fast food restaurants. A white box from the back seat and a bloody artificial plant stalk familiar to the one that was found near Mary's body was found. When the glass fragments were analyzed, it was determined that they had originated from the broken lamp base found on the living room floor. Later on that same Saturday, a police officer located Mary's missing car, a 1972 Oldsmobile. It was found less than 5 miles from Elk Grove Village. It was found in the parking lot of a condominium complex. There was no damage or theft to the vehicle, and nothing seemed to be out of place. A resident at the condo complex would later say, when he left for work around 5:30 a.m. on May the 5th, there had been no car parked in the space next to his. But when he returned home at 5:30 p.m., the Oldsmobile was there. When the Oldsmobile was examined by evidence technicians, 5 fingerprints were recovered, as well as 2 different types of cigarette butts from the ashtray. A blue blanket was in the back seat. Part of the roof liner had red stains on it. On May the 10th, 1976, funerals were held for Frank, Mary, and Michael. It is standard procedure in an ongoing homicide investigation that detectives attend the funeral. They remembered how flirtatious Patty was with the male officers previously, so they decided to have a young, handsome officer attend the funerals. Although Patty had brought her boyfriend, a man by the name of Frank, to the service, Frank, the boyfriend, reportedly sat alone and off to the side while Patty openly flirted with the male officer. Relatives who heard that she had a boyfriend but hadn't met him assumed that the officer was the boyfriend. Frank's older brother, Patty's uncle, lived only a block from Frank and Mary's residence. He told officers that in the past few days, he and Patty had verbally argued over Patty's desire to have her family cremated. The uncle argued that the cremation went against the Catholic beliefs of Frank and Mary, and Patty was adamant that they had to be cremated. once the uncle won the battle, and there was a closed casket for the family. Outside of Patty's flirtation with the officer, her behavior sent red flags to experienced detectives. She laughed and joked while smoking cigarettes outside of the church, and then threw herself wailing on the slate gray coffins of her father, mother, and brother. So it was just one extreme to the other. And the following days during the funeral, following the funerals, detectives checked into Patty's suggestions that Frank had mob ties, but they found nothing to tie him in with the mob or any illegal activity. They decided to focus their attention on Patty. Again, it is standard procedure to focus on those closest to the victims first. And with Patty, investigators had their suspicions. Patty was, Patricia was the first child of Frank and Mary and the apple of Frank's eye. He would call her princess and treated her just like that. Patty had been the center of her parents' world until she was 6 years old, and then her brother Michael was born. Some family and friends would later say that Patty had always been caring and maternal toward her younger brother, but others would claim she was jealous and resentful over the attention Frank gave his son. Patty was very pretty and would easily turn the heads of boys and men. She was known to be wild and uninhibited, but headstrong. She decided to drop out of school when she was 16, and she got a job. She got a job at the cosmetics counter at Walgreens. In 1973, she was caught stealing the credit cards and wallets of two coworkers and spent about $1,000 on the credit cards. On July 1974, her father paid off the amount, but she was convicted of deceptive practices and sentenced to 2 years probation. She was still on probation at the time of the murders. Around the time that she stole the credit cards, she met the boyfriend, Frank. I'll just call him Frank D, because it's kind of confusing when the father's named Frank and her boyfriend's named Frank. Stop it. So Frank D was a university graduate with a pharmacy degree. He had been working at Walgreens since 1961 or 1962. He had been promoted to manager by the time he met Patty in 1972. At the time, he was 36 years old. He was married and he had 5 children, but had the reputation of being a player or a cheater around town. He would say he was a swinger, but to my knowledge, it is something that both partners agreed to, and it seemed that he was sneaking around. So it seems like he was cheating, in my opinion. Patty was not the first employee that he had an affair with, but Patty may have been the youngest. She was only 16 when they started their affair. He was 36. Patty knew that he was married, but still had an affair with him. She would also have sex with other women and allowed Frank D to take pictures and make videos. Yeah, I heard that she would share these pictures with her friends, and one of them involved a dog. So I do not know how she would allow her boyfriend to let her do that, but to each their own. Her parents were not aware of the relationship between her daughter and her boss. So when Patty decided to move out of the family home and into Frank D's family home in 1974, it apparently was fine with her parents, Frank and Mary. Frank D and Patty continued their affair, engaging in sexual acts while his wife Marilyn and children were in another room. At one point, her family or her parents did find out that Patty was involved not only with a man nearly twice her age, but someone who was married and had children. Frank, the father, was understandably upset and disapproving. Patty lived at Frank D's home for about a year, and then one day she came running back home saying that she was done with Frank D and wanted to live on in her own apartment. That was the summer of 75. Psst, psst, hey. Frank was thrilled that the affair was over, and he helped Patty find an apartment in Lombard, a small town known for their annual Lilac Festival. It's about 15 minutes south of Elk Grove. He also agreed to pay her monthly rent. Patty was lying. She didn't tell her parents not only was she still very much involved with Frank D, but that he and his wife were separating. Frank, the father, was not at all happy when he found out Patty was still seeing Frank D, and that Frank D immediately moved into the apartment that Frank the father was paying for. In August of 1975, Frank approached Patty and Frank D in the parking lot at Walgreens, and a violent confrontation started. According to Frank D, Frank the father pointed a rifle at Frank the boyfriend's head and said, "I'm gonna blow your head off." Then Frank the father hit Frank the boyfriend with the butt of the rifle, knocking him completely to the ground. When the boyfriend began to get up, Frank the father hit him again with the butt rifle, this time in the stomach. Patty filed a complaint, but her father was charged with assault. Patty filed a complaint and her father was charged with assault. Frank was arrested, but Patty soon withdrew the complaint. Reportedly, once he was out of jail, Frank made plans to disown Patty and remove her from his will. Frank and Mary apparently had little to no contact with Patty until the late winter or early spring of 1976, when they appeared to mend fences, because Patty and Frank D were planning to get married. Frank D's divorce would be finalized at the end of May. The couple said that they were going to be getting married in June. According to Frank D, her parents accepted the relationship and were even going to give them a new washer and dryer as a wedding gift. On May the 12th, 1976, Patty and Frank D were asked to provide fingerprints, and they agreed. Detective noted that Frank D was missing the tip of his pointer finger on his left hand. No nicks or scabs were noticed on either his or Patty's hands. 2 days later, on May the 14th, detectives spoke with 25-year-old Lanyon, who went by Lanny. Lanny was a car salesman. He first met Patty in September of 1975 through a mutual friend. Lanny said that he had offered Patty money to go out with one of his friends. Patty told him that she was living with her boyfriend, but she needed the money. She also mentioned that her father hit her boyfriend in the head with a rifle butt. In October, Lanny and a friend met up with Patty at a lounge where they drank and they danced. Lanny always carried a gun with him, and he would proudly show it, giving him that badass reputation. Under the impression that Lanny, quote, did favors for his friends, Patty discussed the animosity between her boyfriend and her parents and expressed wanting to have her parents killed. Lanny told her that he would do it for $10,000 a person. He quickly assured detectives that he never had any intention of killing anyone, but was trying to impress Patty so that he could have sex with her. According to Lanny, Patty called him multiple times throughout October 1975, wanting to know when he was going to kill her parents. Lanny stalled by asking for a rundown of her parents' activities and schedules. Patty provided him with a drawing of a floor plan of the house and told him about the wall safe, the televisions, the CB radio, furs, and diamonds. By November, Patty was demanding to know when the killings would take place. According to Lanny, she wanted them done around Christmas as some sort of demented gift to herself. Lanny told his friend Roman, and Roman told him, Lanny called his friend Roman and told Roman about the contract that he had with Patty. Roman told Patty that they needed money up front to continue. Patty told him that the money would come after the killings from the insurance policy. In the interim, however, she offered sex in exchange for, and both men accepted. After one of their sexual encounters, Patty gave Lanny photographs of her family. In early December, Lanny accompanied Patty to her resident, or her parents' residence, as Patty wanted him to check out the house. Mary answered the door, and Lanny panicked. He got in his car and drove down the street and waited for Patty. When Patty rejoined him, she told him that she and her mother got into an argument about Frank D, and Patty wanted her parents killed that night. She said that she left the patio door unlocked so that he could enter the home. Lanny came up with an excuse of why he couldn't do it that night. Another month went by, and in January of 1976, Lanny said that Patty told him and Roman that her little brother was going to have to go too, because he might figure things out if he had survived. Later that month, Patty told Lanny that she once again left the patio doors unlocked, and that she and Frank D were both getting anxious. In mid-March, Lanny called Patty and asked about the upfront money. Patty told him that they wouldn't have any money until the insurance policy, and again questioned whether or when the hits were going to go down. Lanny reiterated to police that he was not a hitman, nor did he have any intention of killing Frank, Mary, or Michael. He simply had been there stringing Patty along for sex and for money. Detectives picked up Roman. He was married and the father of three children. Despite being held at the Elk Grove Village Police Department until 5 or 6 in the morning, he refused to talk. detectives corroborated at least part of Lani's statement was true. After speaking with Mary's sister, Carolyn. Carolyn recalled visiting her sister in late 75 or early 76, and that Patty had just shown up unexpectedly, saying that she was there to pick up something. Soon after, without even taking what she was there to pick up, she had left. Carolyn said that Mary discovered that the sliding glass patio door was unlocked and mentioned that she knew that she had locked it earlier. And so Mary made sure that the door was locked again. On May 15th, 1976, just before 7 a.m., seven detectives from the Cook County Sheriff's Department went to Patty and Frank D's apartments in Lombard with a search warrant. Patty and Frank D were both arrested and charged with conspiracy, solicitation, and the murders of Frank, Mary, and Michael. Although Frank D was released on May 17th, Patty was not. The day she was brought in, she gave a written and oral statement admitting her guilt to soliciting two men to murder her family, but claimed she knew nothing about the murders themselves. She denied knowing Lani, but when detectives continued to question her about Lani, she said that she didn't think that he was the one who killed her family. When asked about the floor plan and the family pictures that she had provided to Lani, Patty claimed that she had been forced at gunpoint to do that and that she also was forced to have sex with them. She claimed that she didn't want to go to the police because she thought the police would eventually uncover all of the evidence themselves. She also repeatedly stated that she was in fear for her life. Detectives later stated that Patty had become irate. After questioned about the apartment that her father was paying for, the rent was late because Frank stopped paying for it, and Patty would get angry and not want to talk about that. On May 26, 1976, Roman was offered immunity in return to testify against Patty and eventually against Frank D. After accepting the deal, he spoke to detectives about Patty and Frank D. He corroborated everything that Lani had said, adding that he had spoken to Frank D on a phone call one time, in which Frank D claimed that Patty's father had taken a contract out on him. And Frank D finished the conversation by saying that Michael, her brother, would also have to be killed. On July 17th, Frank D was arrested once more and would stay in Cook County Jail to await trial. An inmate by the name of Clifford became his cellmate for the next 6 months. According to Clifford, Frank D had bragged that he had been the one to come up with the perfect plan to kill Patty's family, and that he had personally shot each member himself. The plan apparently was that Patty would reconcile with her parents, which would give them a way to arrange a meeting for May the 4th. Frank D said he had scheduled the meeting for 8 p.m., but was purposely delayed until 10 p.m. in order to establish an alibi at Walgreens. Frank answered the door, Frank the father, and when he turned to walk up the stairs, Frank D shot him in the back of the head with a .32 caliber revolver. He then shot Mary, and he and Patty had gone up to Michael's room where he had been sleeping. They woke him up, forced him to stand, and then Frank D shot him in the head. To make it look like a robbery, the house was messed up, and Frank D took $150 cash, some jewelry, and some small household appliances that he put into Frank's Thunderbird. Then they drove to the West Side neighborhood in Chicago and left the car there. Frank D and Patty had expected the car would be broken into and then the contents would be stolen and then traced back to the family, solidifying the robbery motive. Frank D and Clifford had been in the residence for, or Frank D told Clifford, sorry, that he had been in the residence for 25 minutes and that he had worn gloves, even going so far as to stuff the index finger of his left glove. Clifford would later testify that in September of 1976, Frank D told him that he wanted a hit on two witnesses. Both were employees at Walgreens who were going to testify against him. Frank D did not know how to keep quiet. It made statements or confessions about the family murders while at work, and that's what the employees were going to testify about. He wanted the witnesses killed and wanted to know if Clifford could arrange for it to be done. Clifford said that he would do it if Frank D paid for his bail, which would cost $10,000, and it would cost $10,000 per hit. Frank D provided Clifford with the physical descriptions of the witnesses. One was a married woman that he had an affair with before he met Patty. Frank D also gave Clifford detailed directions on how to get to their homes and information on their known activities. Like, on Tuesday we go to soccer practice, at this time they go to Starbucks, and like things like that. Frank D's ex-wife Marilyn was going to bail Clifford out, and Clifford would abduct both witnesses, kill them, bury their bodies somewhere in Indiana. On November 25th, Marilyn sent two money orders totaling $3,400 to Clifford, and then another $830 money order. On February 24th, 1977, Marilyn picked up Clifford and drove him to her home, where she gave him another $1,300 in cash, plus the use of what used to be Frank D's car. Like Lanny and Roman, Clifford denied ever planning to actually kill someone. He said he was just playing Frank D for financial benefits. Patty and Frank D went to trial just over a year after the murders, and chose a trial by jury. The physical and forensic evidence, combined with the testimonies of Lanny, Roman, Clifford, and two of Frank D's former co-workers, guaranteed their convictions. The jury returned only after a couple of hours of deliberation. They were both found guilty on all counts. Both Patty and Frank D were sentenced to 200 to 300 years on each of the murder counts. Patty was also found guilty of solicitation to commit murder and was sentenced to an additional 20 to 50 years. Frank received an additional 10 to 50 years. Frank D moved for a new trial on July 25th, 1977, a month after he was convicted. On August the 8th, 1977, Patty moved for a new trial, but the court denied both motions. Both defendants filed appeals, and both were denied in 1983. Frank D was sent to the Dixon Correctional Center in October of 1977 to serve out his sentence. After 1986, he had no disciplinary infractions or tickets. Under Illinois law, they both became eligible for parole after serving 12 years. In the parole hearing of May 2014, Frank D. told the Illinois Prisoner Review Board that he had no expectation of being paroled, and that what he and Patty did was horrendous, and they both should never leave prison. At the time, the parole board noted that he was in poor health. He had hip and prostate problems and walked with a cane. When parole was denied, the parole board wrote that parole could not be supported due to the heinous nature of the crime, and that parole for Frank D. would depreciate the seriousness of the offense and promote disrespect for the law. On January 4th, 2023, Frank D. died at Dixon Correctional Center from natural causes. He was 84 years old. In 2020, his former wife Marilyn died in her home in Illinois, leaving behind 5 adult children and 16 grandchildren. Patty was sent to the Dwight Correctional Center in October 1977 to serve her sentence. 2 years into her sentence in 1979, she was implicated in a prison prostitution scheme in which she organized sexual acts between female inmates and their correctional officers. She received approximately 20 infractions or tickets. More recent being in 2004 for contraband, unauthorized property, and in 2006 for unauthorized movement. So she's still getting infractions and tickets. Recently, she earned her secretarial science degree and applied science degree in computer programming and an associate's degree in art from Juliet Junior College in 1981. In 1991, she earned a bachelor's degree from Illinois State University. Patty received additional certificates for training in literacy and HIV/AIDS peer education, and volunteered as a reading and math tutor for the Literacy Volunteers of America from 1990 until 2006. She was also a trainer for new tutors from 1995 to 2006. While incarcerated, she worked as a clerk and programmer for Leisure Time Services and the Family Services Program, as a secretary in the placement office, and helped develop the Prison Media Center. Throughout the years, Patty, who preferred to be called Trisha after incarceration, she maintained a group of supporters who would submit letters speaking on her behalf and about her good works at each of the parole hearings. In 2001, and in anticipation of a parole hearing, she was accepted at Leslie's Place, a transitional house on the west side of Chicago that houses and helps former female inmates navigate their way back into society. If Patty had been paroled out to Leslie's Place, she would have been living only 4 kilometers from where her father's car was left, in 1976. In 2014, the Dwight Correction Center was closing. Patty was moved first to Lincoln Correctional Center and then to Logan Correctional Center. In 2014, she asked for a continuance of her parole hearing, as she did not want to leave the special needs inmates that she had worked with. The continuance was denied and parole was denied, with the same notion as Frank D. received. To grant parole would depreciate the seriousness of the offense and promote disrespect for the law. Patty remains incarcerated at Logan Corrections Center and is 66 years old in 2023. Without parole, her earliest possible release date is 2116. She continues to insist that she has changed. Patty and Frank D. have not spoken or seen each other since 1977. Investigator Rose, who was 29 years old when he arrived at Frank and Mary's house in May of 1976, continues to speak against the release of either Frank D. or Patty. He believes that Frank D. shot all three victims and that Patty stabbed and cut them. The motive, in his opinion, was money. Thank you for listening.